The Senate State and Local Government Committee will come to order. Today is Thursday, November 21st, 2013. Thank you all. It's nice to see everybody in their winter garbs. It's cold in here. It's like really winter in here. We have three things on the agenda today. We're really hoping to get kind of ahead of the curve on some of these gambling issues. We didn't really have any hearings at all, except for maybe some overview last year during the committee. So if you have any questions or concerns, this is the time to bring them forward, or later, of course, is always the time. But this is a good opportunity. So we'll start out with the Minnesota Racing Commission. There's no questions to begin with. And we have with us Kristen Batson, who is the Interim Executive Director. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. My name is Kristen Batson. I'm the Interim Executive Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission, and I'm having some technical difficulties. If I could get some assistance over here, I will open up my presentation and get started.
Meanwhile, we can talk among ourselves. Anybody have any good travel stories, any good jokes to tell? I just came back, actually, from Dayton, Ohio. I was there with the Kettering Foundation, talking about civility in politics and how to improve your citizen engagement. So it's very good, very interesting. What about you, Melissa? What have you been doing? Senator Wickman.
I haven't been traveling. I'm going to go to the NCSL Fall Forum.
You're going to the Fall Forum.
Yeah.
Great. Well, hopefully you will see our clip chips at the Fall Forum, our magnet clip chips that say NCSL 2014 Minnesota. As we're trying to promote that we're hosting next year.
Good.
So. Senator Dahl, anything interesting you've been doing?
No, but I taught two sections of civics this morning, so anything good you have to give me for civic engagement would be great. Ninth graders and my AP government
course. Some of the participants in our forum made the rest of us feel like slaggards because they really were so active, and so it had such a system, you know, with students, with community groups, with town meetings, with electronic webinars, you know, just incredible regular radio interviews, a lot of good ideas. But a lot of the secondary focus was about deliberation and how we can engage the stakeholders in the community on difficult issues to have more of a deliberative process. So that was interesting.
Good.
You're set?
I'm set.
All right, we'll have to wait for this side of the table until another break, so get ready with your good stories to tell. All right, proceed.
Okay, thank you again, Senator Pappas. Members of the committee, my name is Kristen Batson. I'm the Interim Executive Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission, and I'm pleased to be with you this afternoon. I've prepared a general overview for you of commission activities in the past year. I'm, of course, happy to take your questions as well. I should also give you my disclaimer. I am the Interim Executive Director of the Commission. I was appointed in mid-June and will continue to serve until a permanent Executive Director has been hired. The Governor's Office and MMB have been working very hard to do that, and they are very close. The mission of the Racing Commission is to regulate horse racing and card club operations at Class A racetracks in the state. As you know, we have two of them. One is Running Aces Harness Park in Columbus, Minnesota. The other is Canterbury Park that does thoroughbred racing and quarter horse racing in Shakopee. Both of these operations have a card room as well as live horse racing. The legislative charge is to ensure the integrity of racing and card club operations for the betting public and to promote the breeding of racehorses to stimulate agriculture and rural agribusiness. Oh, no.
Oh, we have a problem again. I sent Carr to get something in my office.
Typically forwards doesn't forward.
Do you know how it works,
Katie?
She should be back in a
okay.
minute.
Okay. I'll just keep going if it's okay with you.
And we have this in hard copy, too?
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm on my, what would be my third slide now. And Chapter 240 gives the commission the following powers and duties. We regulate horse racing to ensure that it's conducted in the public interest. We issue licenses to racetracks, and we issue professional licenses. We enforce all laws and rules governing horse racing. We collect and distribute all taxes related to horse racing and card playing. We conduct necessary investigations and inquiries and compel the submission of information, documents, and records necessary to carry out our duties. We supervise the conduct of pari-mutuel betting on horse racing. We, of course, employ and supervise personnel. And we determine the number of racing days to be held in the state at each licensed racetrack, something that we're undertaking right about now every calendar year. And then we take all necessary steps to ensure the integrity of racing in Minnesota and to impose fees on racing and card playing industries sufficient to recover the operating cost of the commission. The commission is governed by a board of commissioners that's appointed by the governor. There are typically 9 commissioners, including one chair. We do have one commission seat vacant right now. The current chair of the commission, who was appointed to be chair in July of this year, is Ralph Strangis. There's a deputy director currently interim. There's a deputy director seat open and an interim executive director. Right now, we also have stewards and judges that work at each racetrack to judge and rule on racing issues and violations. We have veterinary staff that are in charge of seeing to the health of horses and testing horses after races. Okay. We have security and investigation personnel. We have administrative staff as well.
And Director Kristen, the executive director is actually appointed directly by the governor, right? Not by the commission?
Correct.
So the chart is a little off then. I would put the executive director next to the governor.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. Agreed.
The deputy director, how is the deputy director hired? By the executive director?
Currently in statute, there we go. The deputy director reports to the commission.
Okay. Meaning that the deputy director is hired by the chair of the commission?
You know, I can't say for sure how it's happened in the past, but our statute says that they are selected by and report to the commission. And I'm not sure exactly what structure they've used in the past to do that, whether they've used a committee or the chair.
So kind of interesting, complicated accountability lines.
I would agree that it is unique in my experience.
Yeah. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
Commissioner, can you tell me what your plans are for expanding racing in the future?
Why don't we let her complete her presentation?
Okay.
You know, do you mind just holding
sure,
that question?
Sure, because it may be in that.
Yeah.
Sure.
All right.
Okay. As I mentioned earlier, we have 2 Class A licensees, 2 racetracks that are licensed by the commission. Canterbury Park is in Shakopee, Minnesota, and they do thoroughbred and quarter horse racing. And Running Aces Harness Park is in Columbus, Minnesota, and they do standardbred harness racing. Just a brief history of horse racing in Minnesota. In 1984, Canterbury Downs first opened as the first pari-mutuel thoroughbred racetrack in Minnesota. After an exciting but short run, they closed in 1991. In 1994, they were reopened under new and current ownership. In 1999, the legislature authorized card room operations to provide additional economic support to horse racing. In 2008, Running Aces Harness Park opened, and so they have been doing live standardbred racing since then. And then another remarkable development is in 2012, Canterbury Park and Mystic Lake created a 10-year agreement to enhance purse structures at Canterbury Racing and to do some joint marketing. And that has really changed thoroughbred horse racing at Canterbury Park and really, really changed the economy and the racing down there. a little bit more on that agreement. It's a cooperative marketing agreement. The two entities are very close geographically to each other, and there's some synergy there. The agreement was approved by the MRC in June 2012. Breaks a lot of new ground with partnering between tribal gaming community and Canterbury Park. And the overall structure of the agreement includes $75 million for purses over the 10-year period and $8.5 million for joint marketing efforts during that period. It has changed purse structures substantially at Canterbury Park. Purses are much bigger. It's changed the type of owners and trainers who want to be racing in Canterbury. A lot more interest in racing there, of course. And all I can say is things are really changing. And it's a very dynamic situation right now. Every summer is slightly different because of this agreement. Overall, live racing operations at both of these tracks. In 2013, there were 69 days of live thoroughbred and quarter horse racing at Canterbury Park. Their season did extend by a couple of weeks from 2012, so it runs basically mid-May to mid-September. And racing there in 2014 will be Thursday nights, Friday nights, Saturday afternoon, and Sunday afternoon. There are 53 days of live racing at the standardbred horses at the harness racing track. Typically, I think their 2014 live racing schedule will be Tuesday nights, Wednesday nights, Saturday nights, and Sunday nights. And again, the live racing season in Minnesota is mid-May to mid-September. Both of these tracks also have card rooms or card clubs that were approved by the legislature to provide additional support to the racetracks. In 2012, Canterbury Park Card Club had generated $26.9 million in revenue. And in our statute and administrative rules, a portion of these funds is directed to go back to thoroughbred and quarter horse breeders' funds to encourage breeding in Minnesota and to enhance purses. And a small portion of that also goes back to standardbred funds to help that breed as well.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
Quick question, Commissioner. Is the difference between the days that are used, operating days, 69 and 53, dependent upon the weather, or they seem to have 4 days a week, same amount of period? Any thoughts on that?
Ms. Batson.
Yes. Senator, it's a slightly shorter season at Running Aces. Each year, each track applies to the commission for live race dates, and Running Aces applied for a slightly shorter season. So I believe the season there is more like June 1 to August 30 or something like that, and the season at Canterbury has an additional week or two on each end.
Okay, thanks.
Card room revenue at Running Aces Harness Park in 2012 was $22.1 million, and again, by statute, a portion of these funds goes back to breeders' funds to encourage breeding in Minnesota, to purse funds, and then some of it goes to thoroughbred owners and breeders as well. In 2012, the legislature approved an additional 30 card tables at each track to provide additional help to card room operations, and they also increased bet limits from $60 to $100.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
To the point you just made or brought forward to us, could the Racing Commission have expanded their tables and increased their bet limits, or did it have to come through the legislature?
Ms. Batson.
I believe it had to come through the legislature, that the commission could not do that on their own. In 2012, pari-mutuel statistics from Canterbury Park, overall, the handle, the total amount bet from live racing was about $11.5 million. The takeout, which is the portion that goes back to the track, although they don't keep all of this, was a little over $2.1 million. Average handle per race was a little over $22,000. And about $8.5 million was returned to bettors on live races at Canterbury Park in 2012. Full card simulcast meets, the overall handle total amount bet was a little over $33 million. takeout was $6.8 million, and better return was $25,700,000 and change.
What's the takeout again?
Takeout is the portion that goes back to the track, although it is not, it doesn't all stay there. The track, it still has some statutory requirements to use those funds in certain ways. But typically every track will have to publish the percent of the total amount bet, the percent of the handle. That is their takeout to inform bettors of how much.
And isn't there some that should go into the purses for the winning horses?
Yes, and that is directed by statute in Minnesota. So that's what I meant when I said not all of the takeout stays with the track. They're okay. They're required by statute.
Purses are included too. In that.
Yes.
Okay. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, did you or did the state profit what they expected to profit through the races and the cards and what you oversee?
Director Batson.
I'm sorry, Senator. I really, in my interim role, I can't answer that because the question has just not come up in the 5 months I've been here. I could do some research if you like.
We should explain that the long-term executive director just retired after 27 years or something, and Ms. Batson actually works for Management Analysis. She's a consultant, and the governor asked her to take over as interim director during the search for a new executive director. So we need to give her cut her
Maybe
some slack.
Maybe we could get that in mm-hmm. the next week.
Absolutely.
So. Thank you.
Yeah. The two tracks are very different. The situation at Running Aces in 2012, total handle was $1,000,001 on live races. That's what's bet on the track at races running there. Takeout that went back to the track, $226,000. Average handle per race was a little over $2,000. And then the simulcast betting at Running Aces, the overall handle was $8.3 million. Takeout was $1.7 million. Average handle per race day is $31,000, and better return was $6.4 million. This graphic shows you a history of racing handles over the year, and I decided to keep it in my slide deck because I think it's quite interesting. To note the very large live handle in the early days of Canterbury Park racing in the 80s. You see live handles exceeding 100 million. And then you see the trend over time where live handle is decreasing. Simulcast handle is helping, but not completely recovering the decrease in live handle. But it just shows you how the dynamics of that are changing. Live handle is quite a marked decrease since the early days of racing in Minnesota, and the simulcast handle has become increasingly important to the tracks.
So that just means less people are going to the track, or people are betting less? Or what should we, you know, a lot of us don't know too much about gambling, so we need to know more.
Chair Pappas, I would say yes and yes.
Okay.
Probably headcount and betting less.
Mm-hmm. Which is why the card rooms were proposed, is to kind of help with that bottom line.
Exactly, Chair Pappas. This slide presents an overview of the Breeders' Fund. And the Breeders' Fund, it was created by the legislature and administered by the Racing Commission to encourage breeding in Minnesota. And this presents an overview of 2012 Breeders' Fund inflows and outflows, if you will. In the thoroughbred breed, live racing and simulcast racing contributed $510,000. Card rooms contributed $305,000 for total earnings of $815,000. There are some administrative costs associated with the fund, so it netted out at $796,000. Grants are made for equine research that come out of the Breeders' Fund. And then additional dollars that are left go to breeders' awards to award folks who breed horses in Minnesota and race horses in Minnesota, and purse supplements as well to increase the purse structure to make racing more attractive.
So Mystic Lake is contributing to the purses, but not to the Breeders' Fund.
Correct. And these numbers do not reflect any of the contributions.
That's a more future agreement.
Okay. Correct. So this graphic breaks it out for the other breeds as well, quarter horse, standard bred, and Arabian. A big portion of the licenses that the Racing Commission issues are Class C or occupational licenses. Each year, the Racing Commission issues approximately 4,500 to 5,000 Class C licenses. And we have public walk-up windows where folks who need licenses can come and get them. Typical occupations that we license include racetrack employees. Each of these tracks employs hundreds of people, and all of those individuals are licensed by the commission. In harness racing, the jockey, if you will, is called a driver. We also, in thoroughbred racing, license jockeys. We license grooms and barn workers. We license horse trainers, horse owners, farriers.
What are farriers?
Folks who shoe horses.
Okay.
All new vocabulary for me, too, I will note. We license vendors who work at the tracks and do business at the tracks. We license veterinarians who work at the tracks, exercise riders. This isn't a conclusive list, but just an example of the types of occupations that we license.
I have a question.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I just am curious, when you license, are there a set of standards in each area that are looked at and regulated? And have you ever taken away a license from someone, and for what reason?
Yes. Senator, typically we look at we do a background check, and we look at the background. We take fingerprints. We look at the criminal record. And we look at the individual's record in other racing jurisdictions or other jurisdictions of any type. And we have certain things that would create a problem for us where we would then go back to the individual and say, we came up with this and we cannot license you for these reasons.
Okay. Anything else?
That's all I have. I'm happy to take your questions.
Any questions? No, Senator Hall.
Thanks. Do we have any plans of expanding racing?
Ms. Batson, are you aware of any plans for expansion of racing in Minnesota?
Again, Senator Hall, I'm not aware of any concrete plans, but I will say that the work that the commission does and the work that the equine industry in Minnesota do to increase breeding in Minnesota is a significant effort to grow breeding and racing.
At the existing tracks?
Yes, and through the Breeders' Fund as being a primary mechanism that the commission uses for that.
Ms. Batson, I'm aware that when the new executive director comes on, you're going to stay in the role quasi-deputy director because there's no deputy director in that position. Since you're from management analysis, after your 3 months, you're there during the transition, will you then be making any recommendations for changes in the operation of the Racing Commission or the operation of the tracks or statutory changes or structural changes in organizational chart or anything? I'm hoping you're going to say yes.
Yes. Thank you, Ms. Chair. Just a little background on that. I am an employee of Minnesota Management and Budget, and I work for Management Analysis and Development, which is a division that does management consulting for public entities. That's my regular job. So I will go back to that after a transition period with a new executive director, and the commission has asked that before I do that, I make recommendations about any sorts of organizational changes that might help the commission in the future.
Okay.
haven't you?
Because I understand the statute is about 20 years old and was written before one of the racetracks running Aces was even up and running and might need some tweaking.
Yes.
Senator Hall.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair and Commissioner. So my understanding is that we had the racing and then the simulcasts were being implemented and the participants of the racing ended up not being as many. And so then we added, if I'm not correct or what I heard, that we added card playing and that helped then. Do we have any thought of expanding that card playing online or any of that in the near future? And if so, do you have the authority to do that, or is that something we'd have to do?
Ms. Batson.
Senator Hall, I do not believe that the commission currently would have the authority to do that. I know that there are parties that are certainly interested in that. So I wouldn't be surprised if that comes up.
And one last.
Is
there or are there any plans to add another racetrack someplace?
Senator Batson. Hall, none that I know of.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions? And now could you just tell me about the board, the racing commissioners, how long are their terms, and are there any kind of term limits as to how long they can serve?
Chair Pappas, commission chairs are 6 years, and commissioners may be reappointed at the governor's pleasure.
Okay. And we did invite the new chair, Mr. Strangis, is it? But he was unavailable to come and speak with us today. He's out of town, so we'll have to invite him again. He's a new chair, just came on in July, I believe. And he was actually formerly on the Racing Commission under the Carlson administration. So he has a lot of experience in this area. So we'll look forward to hearing from him. And I see the gender balance isn't too good on the board. There's only 2 women out of 8. Need to work on it. Tell the governor he needs to work on that.
Chair Pappas, I will note that there is 1 seat open, so we have an opportunity.
Okay, you have an opportunity there. Right. Any other questions from the committee? It looks like under Ms. Batson's able hands that we're putting some of the controversy at Running Aces and the Racing Commission in the past and trying to move forward, thanks to the governor for some of his work in that area. And if no more questions, is there anyone from the audience that wants to testify? I don't think we had anyone who signed up, but it's open if anyone does want to come forward and make any comments. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Pappas.
Okay. Next, we're going to hear from, while the Minnesota Gambling Control Board is coming up, it's time for... What's that school? Teach and tell? No, show and tell. Okay. Senator Peterson, have you been doing anything interesting yet lately?
No.
He's not that interesting.
You don't want to tell a story about your one of your children, accomplishment, or anything you posted on Facebook recently?
I posted some stuff on Facebook, yeah.
So we should all look at your Facebook
page. Yeah, go check it out.
He has a new picture.
I'm on the Facebook and the Twitter.
Yeah, I don't think we're friends, so I'm not following you. Maybe I should friend you,
Madam Chair. That's because we're real friends in real life,
not virtual
friends. Yeah,
right.
Ooh, he's
great.
Good.
Thanks, Senator Scalzi. Anything you want to share?
Well, I've spent a lot of time this summer golfing and at my lake place, and a couple of trips to Florida to see. I've got a couple of small granddaughters, 7 and 9. And my daughter works for Disney, so we go down there and visit them quite a bit. So
nice.
That's been my summer. Thank
Is that you have 2 grandchildren?
I have a total of 5 granddaughters.
5 total.
But 2 in Florida.
Great. Nice. Okay. Well, we'll get to the rest of you before the end of the meeting. I'm channeling Mary Murphy right now, so if you know her, she's a very friendly chair. Mr. Barrett.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Is it Barrett or Barrett?
Barrett. Grin and Barrett.
Okay.
Grinning Barrett.
thank you again for the opportunity to come before the committee. I'm the director of the Gambling Control Board. Just a very brief overview of what the Gambling Control Board does, and that is to regulate the charitable gaming industry. We're the biggest in the country when it comes to activity. And you'll get in, I'll get into some of the reports briefly, but it's over a $1 billion industry in Minnesota, taking place at approximately 2,800 locations. We have approximately 1,200 licensed nonprofits that are licensed to conduct, oversee the charitable gaming. And focusing on the regulatory part, for every dollar wagered on charitable gaming in Minnesota, less than 0.2 cents goes to my agency for the regulation. So we're pretty efficient in that respect when you compare the total numbers. But there's five forms of charitable gaming, pull tabs, and we'll talk a little bit about that, but that's really the bread and butter of the industry, accounting for approximately 91% of the business. But then we also have the bingo, the raffles, something called tip boards. It's a smaller version of a pull tab. And then paddle wheel, not to be confused with the riverboat casino. We had asked that question at one time. But it's like I can associate the Wheel of Fortune, where they have a wheel that spins around. There's a mini paddle wheel that a lot of locations use for meat raffles and happy hour. But there's also a paddle wheel with table, a little more element of gambling and the chance and the pure form of gambling. But those are the five forms. We certainly work close counterparts, the Racing Commission, Minnesota State Lottery, Tribal. When things take place in the industry, whether it's enforcement, whether it's counterfeit money, those kinds of things. So it's been a good experience in my tenure. We have a 7-member board. 5 of those are appointed by the governor. 1 is appointed by the Commissioner of Public Safety, and then 1 is appointed by the Attorney General. But again, our focus is to kind of keep an eye on the industry. I know we've read a lot in the news this past year and a half or so on the electronic gaming, but as I alluded to, Minnesota's number one in the country by far. State of Washington.
Number one in what?
In activity for charitable gaming.
For charitable gambling, yep. Okay.
Happy to report that of the industry, as big as it is, relatively few problems in terms of the regulatory oversight. Certainly due credit to the laws and some of the rules, but also just, I think, the education dedication. And as we'll see, fiscal year 13 was a remarkable year for charitable gaming in the sense of what it's all about, and that's getting money to the bottom line. But I did provide a brief handout. I'm not doing anything electronic, so we can hopefully follow. It's about 12 pages. But the first chart gives you a flavor going back to when lawful charitable gambling was first approved in Minnesota, taking us up to the end of the fiscal year that just ended in June 2013. But you'll notice a relatively recent drop in the 2007 era. That was when we saw the impact of the smoking ban beginning statewide and also the recession. But as you can see in the last 3 years, there's been a marked increase in terms of charitable gaming activity, with the number of sites remaining relatively the same. The next page gives a flavor for those
five. Before we turn to the next page, Mr. Barrett kind of mentioned to me that he felt that the smoking ban, which was in 2008, 2007?
Well, it's kind of started in 2007. There's local communities.
It coincided with a recession. Mm-hmm. And so I think those two combined things created a dip in the charitable gaming proceeds, but you see they're starting to come up again. So.
Correct. And, again, as being regulatory-focused, politically, marketing neutral, those are some of the reasons we see back when the receipts were dropping, legislature asked the board to go back and take a look at what are some of the ways the charities could maintain, because they were struggling on their expense calcs and some of their operations. But for the most part, they've weathered the storm. Their activities are back increasing in terms of the activity. But our regulatory focus remains the same. We're looking at an average of 400 new paper pull tab games every month. That's kind of volume that no other state sees. But the vendors are trying to keep variety of product out there and keep the marketing as well. Our job is just to test the games, make sure that they're good to go before they're offered on the street.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not following. How does smoking affect gambling?
Mr. Barrett.
Yep, Madam Chair and Senator, the best way to describe it is before the laws were passed with the smoking ban, but you could smoke in the bars, and that was the primary sales location. So when the smoking ban happened, and not just pull tab or charitable gaming activity, but the bar industry also saw a significant decrease in revenues from people that didn't go out to the bars anymore because they couldn't smoke. So that's the best correlation. Nothing scientific, but it certainly ties in with what happened.
And I think there's been other studies that showed that people who didn't want to be exposed to secondary smoke were going to continue to go to bars, but these particular bars may have just been where the smokers went. So they had to kind of get over it after a couple years to get used to it. Okay.
Madam Chair, members, the second page is just kind of a capsule picture of all the five forms of gambling and how things progress during the fiscal year by month. One notice I'll direct your attention to is like the column under raffles in the month of January, $1.3 million. That's a seasonal type where a lot of charities gear up for their annual calendar raffle, and it's a very popular amongst those charities. But for the most part, we see a little bit of seasonal where there's drops during the summer months. People don't get to the bars as often. They're enjoying the lakes or what have you. But I think the bottom line literally is the fact that last fiscal year was an 8.4% increase in total gross receipts compared to the previous year. And obviously that'll tie in later on as I get into the use of the net proceeds. For the first 3 months so far in this new fiscal year, again, sales activity is running roughly 8.7% ahead of where it was in fiscal year 13, so that trend is continuing. Where does money go? Simply put, 82 cents out of every dollar wagered goes back to the player in the form of prizes. After that, then we see the expenses, the cost of the games, the labor to sell the pull tabs. Yes, taxes are part of that, approximately a little less than 4%. Retained, that's simply the money that they might have received in net income but didn't spend either on charitable or expenses, so it's in the bank. That's approximately $5 million after the end of the fiscal year. And then charitable, what it's all about. A lot of folks will find this interesting or critical that, geez, only a nickel out of every dollar, but as you're talking about a $1 billion industry, it certainly all adds up. But that's roughly how the distribution of the wager goes for charitable gaming. The next chart is, I think, the most interesting in two respects. One, it shows that the organizations, charitable organizations, did a very good job in maintaining their expenses. It was less than a 1% increase, knowing that the overall activity had increased approximately 8%. But the last bar you see there, charitable, up over 21%. That's remarkable. The board hasn't seen that kind of increase in charitable donations in a long time, and I think that's attributed to, again, maybe some of the increase in activity, but maybe a little pent-up desire to get money to the scholarships, the fire relief, the youth hockey. But it's one of those shout-outs to the charities that for last fiscal year, even though you read a lot about it, it's mostly negative. This was a very positive in respect for what they did with their money.
So, Madam Chair?
Senator Hall.
Commissioner, what then, without adding all this stuff and figuring it out, what percentage does the state make off of charitable charitable gambling?
Yeah, out of every dollar, it's a little less than 4 cents is coming back to the state in the way of gambling taxes.
That's it?
That's overall. There's a little complicated formula when it comes to the gambling tax. The tax the charity would pay on a raffle is different than the tax that they would pay on a bingo game.
Okay.
But when all things considered, it's a little less than 4 cents on the dollar. Next chart, in terms of the charitable gaming.
Mr. Barrett, is that kind of a net after prizes, or is that gross?
Madam Chair, that's gross.
Okay.
Yep. The next chart simply alludes to the number of charitable gaming sites that are currently licensed, 2,822 sites. Of those sites, this is where we're obviously tracking the developments as relates to the electronic games. 295 sites, and then of those 2,822 sites, 185 also carry the lottery games. So it's kind of a combination at one site carrying all forms. But I think the focus has been this past year certainly is what happened with the electronic. The legislature, governor signed off on the allowance for the electronic format, and the best way to pinpoint, and I think this chart shows it, is a little less than receptive rollout at the sites with the charitable gaming. Now, with that said, there's a couple of reasons. I know some charities didn't want to be the first. They want to see how it plays out. We understand that. But we've worked real close with the vendors, the charities, in terms of what was allowed in law. Happy to report, because we're all in this together, be it tribal, be it the lottery, the provisions in law as far as what these electronic devices could do, there are some limitations. And for the games that we've tested and approved and are being played on the street, we really haven't had any complaints from either our tribal counterparts or the lottery in terms of the format that's out there. And that's a good thing. I think we're all kind of trying to proceed in what we allow and how these games play. But the fact is, we certainly expect it to be a lot further ahead in sites with electronics than the 295. Will it increase? We certainly think so. I mean, that's where technology, that's where a lot of things are heading. But the next page is where I draw your attention to those sites for the last 3 months that did take on the electronic gaming. And they're doing very well, well above any of our original projections on a per-site basis. If you look for the month of August, Porky's Bar. This isn't the Porky's on that's gone on University Avenue, but a very small bar in St. Paul that a little further in the packet, I actually included a picture of what Porky's Bar looks like. But you get a flavor for not only the site, but the city. This is not just Metro only. The charity that benefits, and then just some of the numbers that go across. I won't spend a lot of time, but I think the point being those sites that have taken on the electronic format are doing very well. And it's a combination where they work with their respective bar owner. I'm talking about the charities now, but they work with the bar owner and the vendor, who in turn educates the customer, the client, as far as how the games are played. So there's an educational curve. But
so, Director Barrett, since the bars that are doing electronic pull tabs are doing so well, what do you think is the reluctance on the part of other bars not to take on this new technology?
Madam Chair, it's a good question. I think early on we saw examples where we didn't have as many vendors available. We have 3 vendors right now providing electronic games. Tomorrow at our next board meeting, we expect to approve a 4th vendor. There's also limitations on how many distributors to go from a manufacturer to a distributor to the charity, the line of distribution. And we didn't have all the distributors lined up with the products. For the most part now, though, we have 3. Tomorrow will be 4. 9, maybe 11 distributors. Mm-hmm. So that issue of distribution hopefully has been addressed. But we still have, I think, an interest there. The charities are taking a step back, looking at how the different products play. There's different playability. We track numbers in terms of one vendor's product versus another. We don't do any of the marketing in that sense. But we notice, you know, there's differences in playability.
What does that mean, playability? That's for the player?
Well, just the player and how well, you know, if these games aren't selling well, why? It's not necessarily up to us to fix, but it's the vendors. Mm-hmm. And so the vendors are taking a look at their own games, going back to the drawing board, maybe doing a little better animation, focusing on the prize payout, some of those things that'll help.
But it actually sounds like once they're in the bar, they're very, very, they do well, very popular. So it's more an issue of the, you know, the charity and the bar owner, you know, wanting to do it, it sounds like.
Madam Chair, and that's a lot of it, I think, too. There's concerns over the impact of increase in revenue and how it could put them in a different tax bracket. Not here to talk tax implications, but I think the biggest thing is...
You can also ask Mr. Lund some of these questions, too.
Yeah, appreciate that. But I think the point here is just the opportunity to show those sites that are doing it very well. Mm-hmm. And again, be critical of the number of the projections from before, but all these are well above where we expected, on an average, where the sites would be. But it is an example. It does work.
Could you interpret this chart a little bit? Just kind of tell us, you know, how much money does the charity end up getting? And is that, I don't know what PT means. Is that per day, per month?
Yeah, I'm sorry to abbreviate, Madam Chair, but just going across, obviously the gross, that's what the total wager is. And then we talk about the prizes going back, which is roughly 85%. That goes back to the player. So what the charity nets out in gross is the net receipts there. So for Porky's in the top line, $17,000 for the month of August is what the net was. There's 31 days in August, so that's how we get to the average gross per day, mm-hmm. the average net per day. And then the PTs represent the number of pull tab devices, the electronic devices. By law, with the exception of bingo halls, you could have, depending upon small sites, you could have up to 6. If you're a little bigger, you could have up to 12. And that just gives an indication that obviously there's no big sites on this particular chart. But in Porky's case, they're operating 6 pull tab devices. So then it gets to an average per device. And that's actually on a per day. And then an average net per device per day.
So for these different charities, the net is what you want to look at to find out how much they're making per month.
Correct, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
Commissioner, then the average at the end was expected not to be that much, so it's way above what was expected?
Madam Chair and Senator, yes. Chair. In this case, again, these are the top sites.
Okay. Overall, are we doing that? Is it better than what we expected, or to what percentage is it not?
Yep. Madam Chair and Senator, overall I would say not, and that's, again, we've had some sites that have taken on the electronics, but then they put them low. They don't want to deal with them. Maybe they haven't been properly trained how to market them. But, yeah, overall it's certainly not. We expected to be well over 1,500 sites by now, and as it shows, we're less than 300.
And so what percentage are we at? Thank you, Madam Chair. What percentage are we at that we're accomplishing what our goal was?
Madam Chair and Senator, I don't have that detail available, but I think in terms of getting back to the point in time, do you want to do it at the end of the fiscal year? But it's kind of like constantly moving. There's some of the sites did very well, and early on it's leveled off. But I can follow up with you in terms of where we are today.
If we're doing 75% of what we expected, it's nice to know. If we're only doing 25, then we need to be.
Senator Hall, do you mean the amount of money we needed in order to do the debt service on the Viking Stadium?
Not necessarily. I'm talking about overall.
Which is overall what?
Yeah. Charitable gambling.
Are we meeting what we expected? Not just electronic. Okay.
Yeah. Electronic could be part of that. Okay. If we could break it down, that'd be even better.
Madam Chair and Senator, yeah, we can do that. I think just in terms of where we thought we'd be sites, we had expected to be at the 1,500 mark at this point in time, and we're, like I said, less than 300.
Sure.
So that gives an indication of where we thought.
But overall, with charitable gambling, you're up 8%, did you say?
Yes, 8.4% based on last year's activity, fiscal year 12.
But we expected to be up
percent?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Can you repeat your question?
What did we expect percentage-wise to be up this time of the year? If it's at 8%, what did we expect it to be?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator, I guess
Executive Director Barrett.
Yeah, I don't have that, what we expect. I'd have to go back and look to see where
projections
were. Again, what I do recall is we thought we'd be around the 1,500 mark site-wise, but I don't recall.
Well, I think he's talking about overall with charitable gambling, not just with the electronic pool tabs.
Right, but that would have the big impact.
That was supposed to have the big change.
Correct.
Okay. All right, we got it. Senator Scoyer, you're welcome to join us at the table if you'd like. Feel free.
He's hiding back there, isn't he?
We saw you, though. He's a hard guy to hide. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Director Barrett. I'm just kind of curious, if a site has electronic, do they still have paper pull tabs? And if so, are the patrons still using paper pull tabs even though the electronic ones are there? What have you seen?
Same. Madam Chair and Senator, that actually is a good lead into my next chart. But by law right now, if they're selling electronics, they are required to offer paper. If they have paper, they're not required to do electronics. But I know when we first sat down, we thought, okay, this is going to be a new format, and what is the impact? We expected to see a decrease at those sites, decrease in paper, where there was the allowance for the electronics. And again, using Porky's as an example, very clearly shows the solid dark line before electronics, and then electronics, the lines in October, obviously show that kind of an increase, but relatively level, and in some cases an increase in paper. And that's been the biggest surprise in our review, those sites, and we can get a number of sites, but where the paper sales have not dropped off as expected. But obviously, just on this chart, you can see the impact electronic gaming did benefiting the Children's Fund for MLBA. Behind that chart is the simple picture, and I think a picture, if this is the number one site and it truly is a corner bar in St. Paul, there's no searchlights or neon signs. In fact, they got an old ham sign and a pig's eye beer, both outdated beers. But it's the number one site offering electronics, and it's kind of the focus of the picture. We jump ahead of the next one, going up north on the range to Eveleth, where it's the Roosevelt Bar. Again, you can see the impact before electronics, and post with the electronics, again doing very well, and paper sales maintaining. And then the added picture of, again, a very small corner bar that would fit in the size of the table area here. But it's an example where the charity has worked cooperatively with the bar owner and then the patrons that go in there to educate on how the games are played.
Director Barrett, does the bar make a percentage off charitable gambling?
Yes, Madam Chair, very much so. Depending upon how they sell the product or how they offer their establishment, we have what we call a booth operation. You've mm-hmm. gone in where you might see an enclosure. Primarily that's an employee of the charity that's selling the, mm-hmm. the games on behalf of the charity. And then there's the bar operation where it's not as busy of an activity and they sell the games from behind the bar and it's an employee of the bar owner. So different rates apply depending upon if it's a booth or a bar. It could be as low as 10% or as much as 20%.
So the bar owner not only gets the draw of the customers coming in, but they also get – now, does that percentage come off the again, the gross, or comes off the profit, or comes out of what the charity would get, or where does that percentage get applied?
Yep, Madam Chair, it comes off the net receipt. So after the prize has been paid, then like the state with the taxes, the bar with the rent, or the charities for the donations, it comes off the net.
Okay. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Barrett, last time I had heard the e-poll tabs revenue had netted $0 for debt service on the Viking Stadium, based on kind of the recent successes that you're talking about. What are you projecting, you know, by the end of this fiscal year in terms of generating revenue for debt service on the stadium, which is, I think, why these things exist in the first place?
Director Barrett.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator, you're getting into some of the tax element, and that's beyond mine. That would be the Department of Revenue. And they haven't come out with the final numbers in that respect. But along with this allowance for the electronics, there was some tax reform and changes. So it remains to be seen what's available to the net. But I know a few months ago when the articles were coming out and the expectation, zero net. Again, if you looked at the graph summary of the fiscal year, $16 million was focused on electronics. $16 million off of $1 billion, there's not much there in that respect. And I think that was the focus of the activity for the debt service. But, again, you all recognized last year that this might not be the answer to that funding mechanism. And so there was refocus to the some other taxes that have now been dedicated for that aspect.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
I have two questions. In your, is it more people who are gambling or using the e-tabs and paper pull-offs that you use, or is it the same people buying more?
Director Barrett.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator, that's a good question. We don't have that kind of detail to really zero in to see if you're playing $100 and I'm playing $200 or anything like that. We strictly look at, you know, what the receipts have been from the previous year in comparison. Now, we reach out to some of the charities. We've heard back that, yeah, the electronics in some instances have been very stimulating in terms of activity, but they'll also switch over and, yeah, I'm done playing electronics, I'm going to try paper. But we don't get into who the players are. I know the lottery does kind of an annual review of who's gambling in Minnesota and how much are they gambling on a per capita, but I couldn't tell you if we see more people at the locations. All we can tell is we've seen an increase in the receipts.
Madam Chair, that question would be for the owner of the facility to ask if they have more people coming in or not. But and my second question is one that it's a general question, not specific to you. But with more people gambling, there's going to be more people, more problems. More people with problems. And do the gambling organizations, they contribute, don't they, to the fund that helps to deal with people who get into big problems because of gambling? Is that true? And if so, can you tell me a little bit?
Do you know,
about
Director
it?
Barrett?
Well, I can, Madam Chair and Senator, I can give a little bit of insight. Again, we're the regulators over the charitable gaming. But again, the opportunity knowing what our counterparts do and how the industry regulate and some of the consequences from that. But provided in law for charitable gaming is the allowance that a charity could donate to a problem gambling nonprofit or instance. So that's there. I will be up front to say, based on what they spent last year, it's not very much. But on the other hand, our counterparts across the highway, as they say in Roseville, the lottery contributes a chunk of money, and I know the director will be coming up here. But so they'd make a contribution as well that gets funded towards compulsive gambling treatment programs. I'm not sure of the tribal, but I know they're well aware of instances as well, and probably support that. But in terms of what's allowed for charitable gaming, there is a provision in law that charities could donate to those programs they have, but it certainly is not anything of significance.
Thank you.
And then finally, just one last graph, but this takes us down to southern Minnesota, Rochester, but it's a bowling alley, recreational lanes, which normally is very seasonal with the bowling leagues, but again, it gives an indication of the impact before electronics and after, actually doing very well in the summer months. But the point in these last few charts was just to give a flavor as it relates to electronics, what was happening before electronics and what's happened since, and to the extent other charities and other locations take an interest or an opportunity that's been given with the electronics, that's what remains to be seen.
Okay, any questions? All right, thank you very much, Director Barrett. We have Mr. Lund, Executive Director of Allied Charities. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Alan Lund, Executive Director of Allied Charities in Minnesota. Charities Sun, they're welcome. I just came back from Rochester where we started our three-day annual convention where we bring in 500-600 charities. We'll have 1,000 people down there to talk about our business and what we do for our local communities, and they all send their best wishes.
Well, sorry to take you away from them.
I'm very glad to be here. Very glad to be here. So I have some comments.
Please proceed. Mm-hmm.
So our past year, our business was up. Our income was up, which is very good. Our donations, as Director Barrett spoke to, were up. Our expenses were down, which was very good, which means more money does go to the bottom line. One of the quick things that what I would like to expand on what Director Barrett said, we do have sales of $1 billion a year, but our income, the money that we get to take to the bank to pay all our bills and to pay our donations, is $180 million for the last year that we have all the numbers for, the previous fiscal. We sent to the state of Minnesota $41 million of that $181 million. When I do the math on that, that's a 22.7% tax rate. So it's the analogy I always like to use is you go to Cub to buy a $2 loaf of bread, you give them a $20 bill, they give you $18 back. Cub doesn't pay tax on that 20, they pay tax on that 2. And that's how it works for us. We're giving back 82% of what we take in. The money we get to take to the bank to pay bills and everything else is that $180 million, of which we sent in $41 million for taxes. And that's a whole, and I'm not, look, that's not why I'm here today, just to talk about how glad we are that we are able to do what we do and to things we can do at our local. But I just kind of wanted to clear that up because it is a misconception.
Mr. Lund, you know, I know you haven't been with us like Mr. Wilson was, but going back to the origins of charitable gaming, was it always gross receipts tax from the beginning, or was that some kind of compromise that came about to get it passed so that the state would take a cut of the money?
So it has changed, and it changed to being tax on the net in two legislative sessions ago. So how we get taxed is different, and it is now, it's on the net.
It's on the net.
It's on the net.
Mm-hmm. So how does it end up being, but it's still high then?
Well,
on the net.
We would tell you we think 22.7 is a big number.
Yeah.
So, and the interesting part is that's about what we then, we give away that same amount. So we send in about $41 million in taxes, and we gave away about $40 million. Mm-hmm. So, and that, I would love to have that discussion at another time about tax rates, but That's really not why I'm here today. And it again, we the issue with electronics and the adoption by the charities it concerns us all. We saw electronics as a tool, as another way to ensure that we could stay doing what we do in our local communities for another 50 years, because we know that things like electronics are going to play a part. We don't know how big they're going to become. We really don't. But we value them as the tool, and we thank you for that opportunity. Some of the issues that, and you touched on that, the adoption rate is slow. The charities are very conservative in what they do. If you were to only listen to the news, you could only conclude that charitable and charitable gaming was on its last legs. And it all related to the electronics. And if the focus wasn't on building a stadium, if it was just how we were doing, it would generate very little news, because it's going to take us time to develop that business. But we are making plans to come back to the legislature in 2014 with business building ideas on what we think we need to do to reboot the electronics, because we know that without things like some marketing, there is a great misconception among the populace of Minnesota that if you play electronic games, you are donating all your money to the stadium. And we know that that is not true. It is no different than any of our paper taxes that we pay. I like to use the term that the state of Minnesota does not discriminate amongst our games. They like the taxes equally. So whether it's electronics or paper or bingo or raffles, all that money goes into the pot, and anything over $36.9 million now goes to pay for the stadium. But that money was coming in anyway. Mm-hmm. So the people...
Just supposed to be the net above that.
Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am. So we look forward to coming in and working with you to try and work business building ideas that will help us do that. But we really think that long term, it's going to be a very good part of our business.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
Yeah, you're not commissioner. I almost called you commissioner. Director. What you're telling me then is this $36.9 million, that's a cap on what you can receive?
No.
Mr. Lund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how it works, all of our taxes come into the general fund. And then whether it's electronics, paper, does not matter, all of our forms. And every dollar over the 36.9 goes to the stadium fund. So,
gotcha.
And where it used to just all go into the general fund, and we didn't know where it went. That wasn't our business, and we didn't care.
Right.
So there's
nothing to do with you.
So you still get your charitable share.
Absolutely, and that's the point. We try to really stress to people: nothing changed in how we raise money, or the percentage of what we can give away. It stayed the exact same. Mm-hmm. But you all know that the perception out there is that all of this money goes to pay for that stadium, which is not true.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
So, Director Lund, is the expansion of internet gaming a competition to you then?
Mr. Lund.
Madam Chair. Senator, yes, we believe that. And it's an area that will be talked about further today. We're very concerned about it.
Wait, I missed that. What was your question?
If the expansion of internet gambling is hurting the charitable contributions.
Oh, and that's the lottery. You mean
hurting
the lottery?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Any questions for Mr. Lund? All right. Thank you very much. And is there anyone else that wants to testify before the committee or speak to the committee on charitable gaming? All right, then we'll invite Mr. Van Petten to come forward from the Minnesota State Lottery. And while he's coming forward, we'll hear from Senator – did we do Senator Johnson yet?
No.
She's been golfing too?
Madam Chair, I think I'd have to credit you with providing me one of the very interesting event this past year, and that was when I went out to the Will Conference in Washington, D.C., and was there with women legislators from all over the United States and from the international scene. And we had the opportunity and to lobby our state Congress and Senate members, and it
on
was
the day of the shutdown.
On the day of the shutdown.
The day of the shutdown.
And so the senators were milling around on the floor like we do at times, and so we said, let's send a note in and see if they'll come out and talk to us. And both of them did, and it was very, very special for us. And then we visited each of our congresspersons' offices, and that too was. So it was very interesting, something I'd never done before in my life. Hmm. And I appreciate it. Thank you for helping me
Senator
to get there.
Senator Hall, how are the kids doing?
They're doing okay. Grandkids are doing great. We just saw a play, but our new thing is the Fitbit. How many people know what a Fitbit is? Not too many. Fitbit is a pedometer that is hooked up to your computer. Mm-hmm. And so my son gave me one and said, if for 3 months you can meet your goal, which is 10,000 steps or 5 miles a day, mm-hmm. this is free. Otherwise, you owe me $200. and of course, the cost of it's only $100, but he's putting the pressure on. And so I have to meet 5 miles a day walk. So there have been times at 11:30 at night I'm out for a walk, mm-hmm. walking Burnsville Center, walking the Mall of America. And then what I did to help me, although my wife loves it, is about a month ago she got a desk that has a walker. Mm-hmm. So it goes up and down my level and her level. And she works off that all day and spends, you know, sometimes 10 miles she walks.
And you walk while you're doing it.
You walk while you're on computer.
That's a little
tough. But they're a little costly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for asking.
I kind of like the balls. I don't have one, but I like the idea of it, bouncing the ball. Director Van Petten, welcome to the commission.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. First thing I'd like to address that's not in the PowerPoint is we've gotten some phone calls regarding the release of a legal memorandum prior to the hearing we had in the House that we released at the request of Representative Davids, who wrote a letter requesting requesting a copy of any written authority we have on going forward with our subscription sales. We had that in our files, felt like we had to release it. I would say, though, in further review, I've been an attorney 34 years. The problem is if you get 10 attorneys in a room, you're probably going to get at least 9 opinions on things. But on my review of
– be 11.
On my review and our general counsel – our present general counsel's review, Dana Banmer, who's sitting up here if you have other questions of her, we do not think our authority goes as far as Mr. McDonald put in that opinion. However, we do think that all of the actions we're taking at this time are entirely proper. I would also point out that GTEC Corporation and Scientific Games Corporation, probably the two giants in the gaming world worldwide, are working with us on these projects, investing millions of dollars in these projects. They reviewed our business plan and thoroughly. Their legal counsel, Scientific Games, hired an attorney, former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Minnesota, and they were advised by their legal staffs that everything we are doing is within the law and that they were free to invest their funds and go forward. So I just want that background before we talk about it. So we're not going into this blindly. Right now, worldwide.
Before you begin, Senator Thompson.
Yes, Madam Chair and Director Van Petten, you must have been a litigator. You knew to put your weak spot in the opening statement.
I was.
And
for years.
So, I did have access to this memorandum. And I read it, and it is extremely expansive. I'd like to know your opinion as to what elements in this memorandum that are addressed by Dale McDonald, which of the things in here that he says are authorized do you believe are not authorized?
The casino-style gaming on the Internet, I don't think that is authorized.
Okay, Senator Thompson, but then we do want him to do his presentation. But if it's relevant, go ahead.
Well, I can wait till the end, but I'm dealing directly with the topic that he addressed.
Okay.
So I guess the problem that I have is if you look at the enabling legislation by the legislature that directs you to set up the lottery, it's pretty clear that the lottery is supposed to be conducted through retailers. So I have a hard time looking at that statute, and I can pull up the language here, and seeing where Internet lottery gaming is allowed at all. And I'll look at it while you're answering.
Well,
Mr. Van Petten.
I'm not sure how the citations are verbalized in Minnesota, but I'll try. In the rules adopted by under the authority of Minnesota Statute 349A.05, it gives the directors the authority to determine the methods to be used in selling tickets, among other things. There's quite a list of powers, but that is one of them under that section.
Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, thank you, Mr. Van Petten. Yes, but if you look at 349A06 subdivision 1, it says the director shall sell tickets for the lottery through lottery retailers with whom the director contracts. Retailers are defined in Minnesota Statutes 349A01, Subdivision 11, as, quote, a person with whom the director has contracted to sell the lottery tickets to the public. Then it goes on to say that it excludes anyone who is in business solely as a seller of lottery tickets. So looking at this, it strikes me that the intent of the legislature was that these lottery tickets would be sold through retail outlets whose sole business is not that of selling lottery tickets. So I don't even see provision for direct sale to the public through the Internet. I find that to be a very expansive interpretation of that legislation.
In this situation,
Ms. Van Petten.
Sorry, Madam Chair, Ms. Ansender. In this situation, with the Internet sales, Scientific Games is actually contracted as a retailer, and their gaming system operates this for us. And then with the subject will come up again with Play at the Pump and ATM sales. Link 3, the developer of that software, is the retailer on those sales. Both of those companies have many, many functions other than the sale of lottery tickets.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, Mr. Van Petten, and why don't you proceed with your presentation?
Well, the subject of Internet gaming is very sensitive, to say the least, as we know, as we've seen already. One factor, worldwide right now, $33 billion is spent on Internet gambling, $2.6 billion in the U.S. Of that share, if we just take that per capita out, that's about $52 million for the state of Minnesota. The thing to keep in mind is that all of that gaming is offshore gaming that is unregulated, totally unregulated. And, you know, this is the real competition that we need to look at and we need to try to get rid of. I don't think there is any competition. We don't consider there any competition in the state of Minnesota with the other gambling venues, especially the charities. And I think that's the competition we need to look at. Right now, there is no pending federal legislation. However, there have been quite a number of bills introduced over the last few years to totally regulate gaming through the federal government. All of those provisions provide for no benefit to the state, no control by the state. It would be our opinion that the state is much better for regulation within the state of Minnesota, but all of the federal legislation that has been introduced grandfathers in any state program that's up and running. So that's why we feel it's in our best interest to go forward, at least to this limited basis. See, in the U.S., Retail commerce has been increasing gradually over the years, projected for 2014 to be $224 million. The decline in young adult play, and that would be the 18 to 30-year-olds, that continues to decrease over the years. This chart shows the figures in 2003, 52% of 18 to 24-year-olds had at least played a lottery ticket. In 2012, that number dropped to 59%. In the 25 to 34-year-old age group, in 2003, 68% had played lottery. That has dropped in 2012 to 45%. Mm-hmm. And these figures are Minnesota figures from St. Cloud State University. We have been actually selling on the Internet since November 22, 2010, so it'll be 3 years tomorrow. And these figures show that last year was our biggest year, FY13, with just over $1 million, and those sales were 0.2% of our total sales. And I would point out we will be introducing in the next month what we call electronic instant tickets that are, in effect, a scratch ticket sold on the Internet. And I'll show you some of the examples. This is a listing of states that now have sales on the Internet. And I would point out that Delaware just launched full casino gaming on their site, and that is run through the lottery. New Jersey and Nevada have Internet gaming, full casino gaming, and poker. And those games are operated through the casino, licensed casino operators. Within our subscription sales, we have age verification, weekly spending limit of $50 per person, and the individual can set that at a lower amount. If they choose to raise that amount at any time, they have to give notice, and it is not effective for a 24-hour period. And I would point out that with research done by the Minnesota Lottery as well as all of our vendors worldwide, there has been no showing of an increase in problem gambling when regulated Internet gaming is introduced and controlled, such as we are doing here. This is just a screenshot of the site that comes up when you go to the subscription page. This is an example of the first electronic instant ticket we intend to introduce. As you'll see on the right is the paper version of it, and the electronic version is very similar. And we will at first mirror what is available at the retail level with these tickets so the players can relate to how to play the games. The benefits we've seen in our research worldwide with introduction of Internet gaming is that it does, in fact, increase foot traffic at the retail level, and it's been shown that it broadens the demographic base for lottery products, increases the awareness of lottery products, and also makes available opportunities for the lottery to cross-market products at the retail level. One example is the coupon that we show you here. And those can be made available through our subscription sales. In Europe, there are presently 31 jurisdictions that have Internet sales. In the jurisdiction that have Internet sales, the sale of lotto games at traditional retail establishments has increased 11% over the past 4 years. The sale of in jurisdictions that do not have Internet capability have increased by 5. With scratch games, that number is 38% in Internet jurisdictions, 28% in non-Internet jurisdictions. And that is increase at the retail level. And I've picked out three countries that, you know, somewhat mirror the U.S. and Finland. Since they introduced Internet sales, 67% of their growth in sales has come at traditional retailers, with Belgium since 2010. 73% of the growth is at traditional retailers. And the UK introduced their subscription sales in 2003, actually. And I actually think it was 2004, but the slide said 03. And they just did a study between 08 and FY13. The retail sales have grown 27%. Their player base has increased 12%.
So, Mr. Van Petten, the reason for that is just greater awareness of
We think it is totally brand
lottery.
Awareness. Yes, ma'am. British Columbia is the only province that has legalized full casino-style gaming on the Internet. And even with that fact, their total sales on the Internet are about 2.2% of their total sales. And they have reported to us that over the last five fiscal years, sales at their retail level have increased an average of 4% per year, while sales at the on their Internet site have remained stagnant that whole time.
Do the Internet sites typically list where the retail locations are, like you did in that one slide you showed us?
That is available, yes, ma'am.
I mean, is that what these other countries do?
It is on
too?
Our site. I
on
can't
your
tell
site.
You on every site.
Okay.
Also, you asked for an update on our play at the pump, and if you'll remember, last year we started a pilot program with nine locations. We were utilizing a point-of-sale system called Verifone. That system has not proven to be stable at this point. They are still working on it. So with that in mind, we did not choose to expand our pilot program until their software issues were resolved. And I believe it's mostly with banking transactions, but Mr. Toma, he knows a lot more about the point-of-sale systems than I do. Our vendor, Link 3, who developed the software for the sale through the pump, is working with other point-of-sale manufacturers as well as other companies that develop their own point-of-sale. And a company called Gilbarco, we just launched an initial location with them on Tuesday of this week, and thus far it seems to be working completely, and we intend to expand on that pilot, and hopefully in the next month we'll have about 12 locations up and running, and then if they prove to be effective, we'll further expand from there. There are, I think, three other companies that Link 3 is in negotiation with, but we fully intend that this product will be available to any operator who chooses to have it, no matter what type of point-of-sale system they have. Well, it will have to have a card reader on it. And this slide just shows that we actually have surveyed and our nine locations, and that's a very small sample, I realize. Their sales of Powerball and Mega Millions, which are the only two games available on the pump, have increased by 2% rate faster than other stores around them. And sales at our ATM locations seem to not have any effect on the retail environment in the area. And you'll see a quote from the executive director of the Minnesota Service Station Association, Lance Klatt, that they view this as, you know, they are constantly looking for ways to increase revenues. Program allows us to reach customers who never enter our stores. I do know that the petroleum marketers do not feel quite that way, and I assure you, we have a lot of open dialogue and full discussion and full disclosure. Basically, we look at these methods as a multi-channel strategy to increase revenue for the state and our retail partners. The retail industry is always introducing new technologies for the market of their products, and we feel that we have to lead the way or at least keep up with them with the Minnesota Lottery, and feel that the online presence increases brand awareness and product awareness, and thus foot traffic into our retail partners. And with regard to the internet possibilities, I feel that we need to move forward now to protect ourselves from federal regulation later. I would stand for questions.
Okay, are there any questions from the committee? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Van Petten. First off, I love your low voice. You ought to be on radio. It's that Kansas in you, isn't it?
I think it probably is. I get accused of that a lot.
Yeah, I see we've it feels like we're expanding gambling. Would you say that's what we're doing?
I really don't view. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Senator. Your protocols are different up here too. I'll get used to it. I don't view this as really an expansion of gambling. We're just making our products that are presently available for internet sale. And in all jurisdictions that have done this, we're not going to make a great deal more profit by having this available, but it is a convenience to the players. And we have found that some players are perhaps homebound that buy the subscription sales. We found that some folks who are going to be out of state for an extended period of time, perhaps the winter, like to buy the Minnesota, state-based, like the Gopher 5 game before they leave, because they're going to be out of state. And I would point out, you have to be within the state's borders to purchase a ticket through the subscription sales. So we're not making any additional products available. So I fully understand how some would argue it is an expansion, but we really don't view it as such.
And, Madam Chair?
Senator Hall.
My next question is, I'm assuming the governor is in agreement with this expansion, the way I call it expansion.
I understand. Yes, sir.
And believes he has the authority to do that.
Mr. Van Petten.
As we heard.
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, I do believe that to be the case.
Now,
Senator Hall. And
Madam Chair, you just made a statement about they have to be in the state. How do we know somebody's in the state if they're doing it on internet? Is there a way that we can keep track of that, or can they be doing it from Florida but tell us that they're in state?
Mr. Van Petten.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm not a very technical person. I am assured by my technical people, maybe perhaps Ms. Canfield can address this question.
Would you introduce yourself for the committee?
Jenny Canfield, Director for Operations, Minnesota State Lottery. Madam Chair, Senator Hall, members of the committee, we do have geolocation technology embedded within our programming, and to try to keep it in very non-technical terms, that technology does verify that the individual is in the state of Minnesota when that purchase is made.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things I was interested to hear was that your interpretation of the law is that the lottery retailer is also, or that these third-party entities, in fact, you're saying qualify as lottery retailers. In the definition under the statute, I'd imagine they also qualify as lottery procurement contracts to these same individuals. And lottery vendors, for that matter. Are there other instances under the current situation where individuals are both, or entities are both, lottery retailers and have lottery procurement contracts and lottery vendor relationships with the lottery?
Mr. Van Petten.
Madam Chair, Senator, within the state of Minnesota?
Yeah, we're talking about the Minnesota lottery.
I'm not aware of any, but with regard to Link 3, we have no procurement contract with them. They simply act as the retailer. With Scientific Games, we do have procurement contracts with them on other issues such as scratch tickets.
Okay. That's all for now. Thanks.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Van Petten or Ms. Canfield, is that your name?
Yes.
Maybe I missed the subscription part. But is that to access internet gambling, do you have to ultimately subscribe? And is that where age verification, weekly spending limits comes in the whole process?
Yes, there is a sign-up subscription that you sign up, give banking information, Social Security number, of course, because we have to pay out prizes. Through the banking information and the last four digits of Social Security numbers, we are able to verify age through those systems.
Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, once you've subscribed, then you can go to the ATM or the pay at the pump. Is that how that works, or does that work differently?
Mr. Van Patten.
Madam Chair and Senator, totally differently. The subscription system is simply through the Internet. The play at the pump and the ATM system is a system of Link 3 software that they developed, and it is a transaction just done at the gas pumps or at the ATMs through the use of a debit card.
And then do you have to show your driver's license, too?
I think for it's the verified age? Through the...
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Yes,
through the play at the pump or the ATMs, currently there is, for the first time that debit card is used, there is age verification through that process, which is different as was mentioned than the Internet. But you do have to swipe your driver's license, and there is an age verification that is completed through that process.
At the ATM or at the pump or both?
At both of them.
At both, okay.
There is some newer technology with some of the newer POS, the Gilbarco that was mentioned during the presentation, where the verification will be done based on the information that is done, that is obtained from the debit card and also entering the last four digits of your Social Security number. And to speak more directly with the Internet registration process, there is a company that upon registration, and it's all automated, that will verify that the individual is 18 years of age or older. If not, it will not allow that individual to register, in which case they cannot make any purchases.
Okay, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm interested in, earlier you had given your interpretation of your authority and kind of stopped short of full-blown casino online gaming, but you do believe that you have authority to do other electronic gaming, and you've just stated that you're interested in doing electronic scratch-off-like games online. I'm just curious about what your, because I can't discern in the statute the difference between those two things. I'm just curious why you're drawing the line there as it relates to your perceived authority in the statute at scratch-off games versus anything else. I don't see that in the 349A anywhere that would indicate to me why the logic behind that decision. So if you could just kind of illuminate that for me.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. Yeah. Anyway, the statute that there is a limiting statute, and it specifically says that we cannot not have a game that is determined upon the insertion of coin or currency, and that is the way, you know, slot machines are typically played, whereas with our tickets, the ticket is purchased during the financial transaction, and is then determination of winner or non-winner is made at a later time, especially with the lotto style games, because the drawings are at the most once a day, some of them two times a week, some three times a week.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But with that's not necessarily the case with an electronic scratch-off. I mean, there's no limitation on the number of times that an individual could
purchase. You don't do electronic.
But
are you talking about electronic pull tabs?
Madam Chair, what he suggested in the hearing today is that the plan is to move towards electronic scratch-off-like games. And he cited that he has the legal authority to do that. So
I see.
Whether they're doing it or not now is not so much what I'm talking about. It's the fact that the director suggested that he has the authority to do that. And I'm wondering, I think you understand my question. What is the why is that the ceiling on your authority? And in where I was getting to with the most recent example is you had mentioned that there's intervals between the lottery. With a scratch-off, that's not the case. You could purchase, if you had the means, you could purchase a virtually unlimited amount of scratch-offs inside of a day's time.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator, we do have spending limits built into the system of, like I said, $50 per week. So it wouldn't be an unlimited number of purchases. But the scratch tickets can be purchased and held and played at a much later time, whereas a slot game is not that way. When you activate a slot game or a spinning wheel game, it plays immediately. And we felt like the legislature intended those types of games to be limited and not available through the lottery.
That's all for now. Thanks.
Okay. Senator Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am quite concerned about kind of the frame of this message that you put in here. Internet presence can have positive impact on retailer sales, and it broadens the demographic base. And it's such a, you know, positive frame for those who agree with this, and I just happen to that concerns me immensely, because when I think about demographic base, I'm thinking about my sons, who are 16 and 18, who could be very excited about the possibility of using the internet to do this. So my question is, let's play with a scenario that I think an 16, 17-year-old could be very capable of doing, which is getting a Social Security number just to play games in the internet and to do this in the internet. Is it a control? How do you control that? I think it's an impossible task to control. But is it, for instance, an announcement that could be provided that says, you know, if you happen to win, you cannot collect, because obviously what you did was illegal, and what will happen as a result of it? Do you have some kind of mechanism to let children know if they are doing, how do you do this? I'm trying to think about how do you put controls for access to that kind of age?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Canfield.
Members of the committee, Senator, there is an age verification that is completed. As part of that age verification, just to expand on that, and I apologize I didn't previously, there is an identity verification. So even if, and I do have teenage sons, so I can appreciate where you're coming from, even if my teenage son did obtain a Social Security number, and he's going in to register under his name, there is going to be a verification that has to match. So as part of that age verification, it also does an identity verification. And there's really not any incentive for somebody to register under another name, because then they're not entitled to those winnings. The individual that's registered and that actually makes the subscription purchases is going to be the owner or the recipient of any winnings. They would also have to obtain a banking information, and it has to be a valid bank account that has funds in it.
Mm-hmm. Senator Arthur.
Madam Chair, thank you. But that's my question. So let's say that I am a 17-year-old and I happen to have a Social Security. So when I enter and I use that Social Security, I'm moving. I'm doing this in the internet because it's under a different name. So,
wait, is it a warning? Own Social Security card?
No, I mean, you know, if you're a 17-year-old and you have access to another number, that number that goes in and that you know that a minor just happens to know the name, and so it goes under another identity. Is it a warning that comes in and says, okay, you know, you're entering this system with this number, and if this is not you or this is not your number, So in other words, you know, when you deal with 16 and 17-year-olds, you have to be very obvious, very clear. You're doing this. You're about to access this system. This is legal or illegal. So my question to you is that how that system works? Is that what you have in your system right now?
There'd be a warning before arrest comes.
Right, exactly. Because if they move on and just do it, they go later on, because 16-year-olds do that. Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Nobody told me that that was a problem. So is the system clear enough and obvious enough that says, you know, these are the rules of this process and this game?
Ms. Cornfield.
Madam Chair, Senator, members of the committee, absolutely, they do have to accept terms of service. And we do have several notifications that you must be 18 years of age or older. Again, it's very likely that they would not, they would not pass the registration process just by obtaining someone else's social security number that is over the age of 18, because their name has to match that.
And their debit card. They'd have to have a debit card that
and
also
their bank
matched.
Account, correct.
And why would they want the winnings to go into someone else's debit card
right.
account? Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, we need to move on. So let's ask Mr. Kevin Thoma to come forward. And while he's coming forward, Senator Torres Ray, we were having a little show and tell. So can you share with us some interesting or exciting thing you've done lately or your children have done? Something you want to share with us? And I think Senator Thompson, hopefully he didn't leave for good because he didn't get to share.
Well, this summer has been very busy for me, but it has been fun. I've been traveling with you some, too, so that has been fun, Senator Johnson, that, Madam Chair, you have offered some great opportunities for us to visit with other women throughout the world and the country to talk about women's issues and health care and education. Lots of meetings with people in different schools. I am mentoring 37 Latinas in Roosevelt High School in my district, and I meet with them every other week. So I had a meeting yesterday, and it's a lot of fun to meet with the girls and really talk about their plans for graduation. They are all of them are ninth graders, and we're planning to, you know, kind of figure out if we talk about, you know, what they are doing and their plans for graduation and pursuing college will work. So I'm
going to
be
doing
this for 4 years with these girls. We'll see what happens.
We were talking a little earlier about citizen engagement and youth engagement, and that sounds like a great plan.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Lots of fun.
Mr. Thoma, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Thoma, and I work for the members of the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. The members of the association have several concerns regarding the recent introduction of Play at the Pump and the impending introduction of the online games. In the interest of time, I'm only going to address a few of our concerns. Our members own convenience stores. Our members operate about 90% of the convenience stores in Minnesota. Our members include the mom-and-pop stores, the Holidays, and the SAs, and they pay property tax and employ hundreds of people in each of your districts. As a classification of retailers by the Minnesota State Lottery, convenience stores rank second only to grocery stores in lottery sales. I'm pretty sure that every member of the committee has a favorite convenience store that you go to that has great coffee or a fantastic car wash. Play at the Pump is currently available at 9 locations. The lottery is going to expand the group to an undisclosed number of locations in yet another test program. Our members are the Minnesota Lottery's customers. We see this as a state picking winners and losers. If you're lucky, your location gets picked over the other retailers in your area and you get free equipment, and that equipment can cost about $10,000 per pump. And then you can operate as a Play at the Pump location. The lottery's partner, Link 3, is currently working with two point of sale providers to provide the necessary free equipment for the test. Our members use dozens of point-of-sale equipment, some of which are manufactured here in Minnesota. If you are not currently running a Select Verifone or Gilbarco point-of-sale system, you cannot run the required software to participate in the test. Think about this. If you own a convenience store across the street and you cannot run the required software on your point-of-sale because you run a Radiant point-of-sale, the lottery and partner Link 3 may provide your competition with free hardware and software to participate in the test program. Our members believe this is not what the legislators intended when the Minnesota Lottery was created. Secondly, the C-Store classification, as I mentioned earlier, is the second largest classification of retailers for the Minnesota State Lotteries. Our members have helped build the lottery. Now the lottery intends to expand into internet gaming. Our members believe that Play at the Pump, the internet lottery, are an end-around way for the lottery to cut out lottery retailers. Our members pay property tax and, as I said before, employ hundreds of people in each of your districts. Our members rely on the proclaimed partnership that the lottery claims it has with each retailer. A true partner would try to grow sales with you or my members rather than doing an end-around and cutting us out of the relationship. We would ask the members of this committee to inquire as to when the Minnesota State Lottery was given the statutory power to offer lottery games outside the sale of the retail system. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Toma?
Just Senator one Johnson. Question. You said you had 90% of the facilities out there, of the gas station owners?
Mr. Toma.
Madam Chair, yes. Our membership includes about 90% of the convenience store retail locations in Minnesota.
And are they, Madam Johnson. Chair, and are they big or little
Mr. Toma.
Owners?
Senator.
Big stations.
Madam Chair, Senator, we have everybody as members in our association. We have folks that pump as few as 30,000 gallons, which is about 300,000 gallons a year, all the way up to locations that pump over 1 million gallons a year.
Madam Chair, one more question. Have any of your members been chosen as a site from the lottery?
Mr. Toma.
Madam Chair, no. Our members have not been chosen.
And it's a question we could ask Mr. Van Pelton, if you don't know. Is there a reason for that, or why not?
Mr. Toma.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm not sure of the reason behind that. We were not brought into this game or the new Play at the Pump until one of the other association's members called us and asked if it was legal to take a credit card for lottery. That's how we found out about the test, the pilot that was going to happen.
Okay. Thank Sounds you. Like it's been a pretty small pilot. Yeah. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And that brought a question to my mind when you just talked about the credit card, because I had a constituent say to me when I was talking about this meeting today, the constituent said, my understanding was when we authorized the lottery that we would never be able to use credit cards to play the lottery because it was a slippery slope. And I don't know if anyone else had that perception.
I don't believe you can, Senator Scalzi. They talked about debit cards.
So then the credit card at – thank you, Ms. Chair. So then the credit card at the play at the pump is not usable with the debit card. But then
– That's my understanding.
Right. Okay. So that's good. I can talk to my constituent about that because it's a concern out there. And I think that when we're talking about a lottery on the Internet – and we're only talking about a debit card on the Internet. Is that correct? Am I correct in that? Or how did you mention credit card in your comments?
Yeah. Mr. Toma.
Madam Chair, Senator, I mentioned credit card because of the inquiry that we had from a gasoline retailer
who didn't understand the program at the time and was concerned that the lottery, which you cannot play lottery with a credit card.
Right.
He was concerned that the credit card readers have the capability to read credit cards if that was going to be legal or illegal.
Right, and it's easy to mix up a credit card and a debit card, too. But credit cards, I don't think, are allowed. Okay, next, any other questions? Next, we have Mr. Al Lund coming back before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Al Lund, Executive Director, Allied Charities. I believe in your possession you have a position statement from Allied Charities. And then also, you just received today, because our board just approved making this public, an opinion from our attorney, Mary Magnuson from the Jacobson Law Group, that our opinion would be that they do not have the expressed authority to do what they're proposing to do. And our concern deals with the impact on local needs. And we can't tell you what that impact will be, but we know that there will be an impact. We certainly do not believe that the legislature's intent was to give the lottery the ability 24/7, 365, to have people gambling from their homes on literally millions of devices and never having to leave their home. Our business is done at 2,800 sites today, and that's how we like it. We want to see who you are. We want to know that you're of legal age to play our games. And this concerns us greatly. We're talking about literally a 1,000-fold increase in the ability to play games when this can now be a gambling device.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
Chair. Mr. Lund, can you, in looking at this from your attorney, are we expecting a legal challenge then, do you think, from someone if this continues?
Mr. Lund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, we are discussing those possibilities. We have not made any decision on that at this point.
Okay, any more questions for Mr. Lund? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Who is the gentleman who couldn't be here? Is that Mr. Grassler? He is here. It's not like Randy Bingaman.
This guy here.
North Star problem.
Oh, so Mr. Grassler is here. Okay, Mr. Grassler, yes.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jacob Grassel. I represent Citizens Against Gambling Expansion. Our members come from every corner of the state and every walk of life, and like our coalition partners, from both sides of the aisle and every religious persuasion. They fight passionately against the expansion of gambling for a myriad of reasons, including moral, social, and economic beliefs, but are all united by the singular belief that we already have enough gambling in the state of Minnesota. The coalition members include those from the recovery community who deal with the problems from gambling addiction and the many other addictions born from gambling each and every day. We are opposed to the continued expansion of the lottery, especially to online gambling, for a variety of reasons, including the unauthorized implementation, many societal concerns, and the negative economic impact this expansion will have on our state. While we strongly oppose internet gambling in Minnesota, we vehemently oppose unchecked and unfettered internet gambling that is not authorized by the legislature and regulated by an independent agency. The lottery, which authorizes, markets, and regulates its own games, can certainly not be considered independent. Any expansion of internet gambling must be authorized by the state legislature. Secondly, the societal impacts of expanding gambling to the internet are real, and they will reach into each and every community and devastate lives across the state of Minnesota. The lottery's stated purpose of expanding gambling, which you heard today, was so that they could reach and and attract a new generation of Minnesotans to gambling, all in the hopes of generating revenue for the state. I ask you to consider, at what cost? Independent studies have shown that for every dollar earned from gambling, the community has to pay $2 to $3 in social and economic costs. These same studies have shown that the propensity for problem gambling is most concentrated within a radius of 25 miles from a casino or gambling facility. The expansion to the internet will mean we have a gambling facility in virtually every home, library, and Starbucks across Minnesota. How many lives, families, and careers do we need to destroy before we say enough is enough? It's just not worth it. Finally, the economic ends certainly do not justify the means. There are many reasons why the economics of expanding gambling do not work. It costs jobs. The revenue generated comes at the expense of legitimate industry. It causes divorce, crime, and a whole other set of issues. However, I'm going to leave those for another day and leave you with this. The expansion of gambling, and gambling in and of itself, is a policy that relentlessly encourages citizens to lose money. Gambling is a major factor in America's debt culture, which disproportionately affects the poor. It has turned a nation of small earners, who could be small savers, into a nation of habitual bettors, leading people who eagerly desire to become more financially secure down a dead-end road of deeper personal debt. Rather than encouraging people to invest in a 401k, an IRA, our government is now actively conditioning people to invest in a lottery ticket to shore up their personal finances for retirement. The lottery asserts their authority to expand internet gaming so that they may continue selling false dreams of prosperity based upon a logical chance to the next generation. However, capitulation to this notion will only leave a generation wishing they had saved rather than squandered, and the government will be left picking up the pieces. Therefore, I urge this committee, the entire state legislature, and the upcoming session, and the governor to rein in the lottery and prevent this unprecedented and unauthorized expansion. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Mr. Grassl? Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Grassl, I really appreciated your bringing forward the $1 win and $2 cost to the state. Do you have a report on that you could provide to us, the cost of treating addicted gamblers?
Madam Chair, Senator, I do have that, and I could provide that to the committee. I can provide that to Kara to distribute to the committee.
I appreciate it because I think, all of us want to try to reduce expenses for the state, and certainly it isn't very difficult math to figure out, and I think that we should all be aware of that.
Thank you. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Grassl, and I see your Citizens Against Gambling expansion. Is it fair to say you're opposed to most all gambling? And or in terms of the expansion piece, is there something that you heard today that's especially troublesome to you? What I'm trying to get at is the horse racing, the current lottery system, is it the electronic pull tabs, is it the ATM, is it the play at the pump? Is there something that we think that we maybe tipped the boat, so to speak?
Madam Chair, Senator.
Mr. Grassl.
Our organization is focused on the expansion of gambling. We have members who are opposed to gambling at any level, others who just want to make it stop. We are opposed to every expanding proposal that we heard today. Pay at the pump. It wasn't necessarily addressed in the lottery and the online gaming. I do have concerns that a parent could use their debit card at a pump, and their 16-year-old teen son gets that debit card to go fill up with gas and starts playing lottery in other games. So I do have concerns there as well. But we have seen over the course of Minnesota that whenever you introduce more gaming, for instance, we spoke with many of you in 2011 about the projections for e-gambling. or e-chair to the poll tabs, and how greatly exaggerated they were. And as you see now, proposals coming up to shore up those finances. I think gambling leads to more gambling, and we need to, as a state, say no, no more gambling, especially now that it's targeted at a new generation of Minnesotans, that we need to not say, hey, put your money in a lottery ticket. We need to be encouraging them to save it for a rainy day.
Okay, thank you very much. Then Autumn Leva, and as she's coming forward, I just wanted to call to your attention, there's a letter in your packet from Mr. Randy Ringeman, who could not be with us today, but he has a very heartfelt letter that he sent to us. Ms. Leva?
Leva.
Yes. Welcome to the committee.
But members of my family say it both ways, so you can too. Good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee. Thank you so much for allowing me to be here today to testify. My name is Autumn Leva. I'm the Director of Legislative Affairs and Communications for Minnesota Family Council. And I have just three brief points this afternoon to address why we believe that online gambling expansion is a bad idea for Minnesota. The first and most basic point is that the state government should not be in the business of predatory gambling in the first place. The state here is essentially encouraging taking money away from Main Street and blowing it on Easy Street. Wouldn't it be better for that money to flow into Minnesota businesses and job creators so that Minnesota families are benefited from that? The state is encouraging behaviors of addiction and indebtedness as opposed to saving and responsible financial planning as a way of life. I believe that Mr. Grassel also addressed this. The state is preying on society's vulnerable, which also means a societal impact on those vulnerable's families, friends, and workplaces. And internet gambling expansion opens the door for more people to become vulnerable to compulsive gambling. So the state government should not be in the business of promoting and profiting from potentially addictive activities that we already know can destroy families, ruin marriages, exploit children, hurt our poor, bankrupt communities, and raise crime. The second point is that online gambling is a huge expansion of the most addictive form electronic gambling. This is considered the crack cocaine of gambling because the high one gets from electronic gambling is essentially the same as one that one would receive from a cocaine-induced high. This huge expansion would bring this highly addictive behavior into the home by allowing those already addicted to fill voids on a daily, sometimes hourly, basis without even leaving their homes. And for those not yet addicted, this expanded source of gambling increases the ease, convenience, and anonymity of gambling, making it even easier to become addicted. The risks of expansion are far too great. With family budgets already tight around Minnesota, according to SMR Research Center, gambling is the single fastest driver of bankruptcy. Is this really the direction we want to go? New sources of gaming come with an increased risk of exposure and access to children and teens. Are the safeguards strong enough? As Senator Torres-Rey was questioning, we're not sure that they are. And this brings me to my third and final point. Expansion of internet gambling will prey on Minnesota's young people. According to reports from the Star Tribune and Care 11, Minnesota Lottery Director Mr. Van Petten has already admitted that the goal of this expansion is to cater to younger players and expose more people to the games. Dr. Van Petten referenced the existence of online games already in the UK, which I believe actually came into place in 2005, not 2003. Interestingly, according to the BBC, the number of 18 to 35-year-olds contacting the UK's leading gambling advice service, so for those with a gambling problem, the service is called GamCare. Those 18 to 35-year-olds contacting that service has risen for the third straight consecutive year. 60% of their calls in the past year are from that young age group. GamCare itself says, and I quote, "Smartphone and online betting are playing a big part in the rise of young people developing gambling problems. They also note that young people have been reported to have a particular vulnerability to developing gambling problems." The BBC also told the story of a young man named Adam, 24, of Derbyshire. They say, Adam says using his smartphone to gamble was, quote, disastrous, and it became an addiction. He said, "You can be out anywhere. You can be in the park. You can be anywhere. You can literally be on the phone and having bets there and then." He also says he spent more on gambling than his friends spent on 5 years at the university studying courses. Minnesota's young adults and their families deserve better. With young people already susceptible to gambling problems and already struggling to launch fledgling careers and families, introducing state-sponsored online gambling to make them an even greater target for the predatory gambling industry is a bad idea. Mr. Van Patten asked us to take a look at the UK. We did, and their young people like Adam are already feeling the harms of expanded online gambling. Online betting in the UK has become a £2 billion business. Problem gamblers have reached 1 million, and hardcore addicts have doubled in 6 years. And the number of people with gambling addictions has risen. Number of young people with gambling addictions has risen each consecutive year. The families of Minnesota deserve better, and we disagree with expansion of internet gambling. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? All right. Thank you all very much. A lot of food for thought. And is there anyone else from the audience who wanted to testify? Remember to say that. All right. Seeing none, then the meeting is adjourned.
Can I ask questions?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see you over there.
I was waiting for everybody to kind of get done.
Yeah. Okay. Center Hall, who did you want to ask questions of? Or did you want to just have a comment? Make a comment.
Yeah. I wanted to maybe ask anybody, have the tribes jumped into this and decided that this is good for them, this expansion, or not good for them? I've not heard from anybody that represents the tribes. Is there anybody here?
There are, but I don't know if they wanted to make any comments. I asked for if there are any comments from the audience. No one signed up to testify.
Okay.
So I don't know that the tribes have kind of weighed in on this.
Okay.
Not with me.
And then, Madam Chair, would it be your intention to let this expansion continue on? Do you think it's legal for them to do that and have they have the authority, or will you challenge that this year in some kind of legislation?
Well, Ms. James and I were just discussing that since we have kind of competing legal opinions, maybe we need to ask for an opinion from the Attorney General so we know what kind of where we stand on legal grounds. Okay. And is that the appropriate thing to do, Ms. James?
Madam Chair and members, that would be a way to get another well-researched opinion on the issue.
So, Madam Chair, will you be doing that? And do you know how long it takes to get an opinion from someone like?
I don't, but I can't imagine it wouldn't be ready by the session, since
that's
the end of February. It doesn't take months and months.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
And then I do think that we need to look at the Racing Commission's statutory to look to see, just to kind of clean it up. So that the lines of authority are clear and we have some kind of clarity there. So we're going to look into that. And that's why I asked Ms. Batson if she was going to be making some recommendations there.
Okay. One last question, it might be to Mr. Van Patten. At some point, there
was Mr. Van Patten still here?
Yep.
Yeah, there he is. Okay.
Mr. Van Patten. At some time, you were talking about the $50 a week limit, and I just wondered, is that a policy that you put together, or is that legislation that was put together that said there's only a $50 a week limit?
Mr. Van Patten.
A policy issue. We have worked very closely with the National Council on Problem Gaming in developing these programs, and in fact, they have a set of protocols that they have adopted to suggest with internet sales. And so we have followed those protocols. I would point out that our director of research was the president of that council for 2 years and is still on the board. In fact, that's where he's at now, is at a board meeting with that board. We've been very active, and in fact, every month, maybe quarterly, we host the North Star Alliance on Problem Gaming at our offices and provide them meeting space.
Great. Then, Madam Chair, it just concerns me that these are policies that can be changed, not by legislation, but, you know, tomorrow that could then be changed to $500 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think, like you just said, we need to kind of retake a look at that. If it's that kind of expansion is so easy and not done by legislators, it concerns me. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Point well taken. Any other comments? Questions? All right. Thank you all.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Van Patten.
One question that was asked of Mr. Toma that he wasn't aware of, and I could clarify real quickly. With regard to our initial pilot program, That was a pilot program that was initiated by Verifone to test some new software that they had developed, and they just allowed us to piggyback on to their program. So I have no idea how those nine retailers were chosen. With regard to the one Gilbarco that we started on Tuesday, my understanding was that that station was a member, in fact, but I could be mistaken on that. But it was, and I don't even have the name of the station with me. And I'm sure Mr. Toma would not mislead the committee, but I believe that to be the case.
Okay.
And that station is in Worthington, Minnesota. So.
Okay, thank you very much for that clarification. The meeting is adjourned.